we're labeled the DevOps team. I consider ourselves more of a research ops team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we don't really have a lot of actual direct developers that we work with. We do have some. But there's a lot of challenges that comes with modern, you know, biomedical research. Probably the biggest one and the easiest to identify is data size. Mm-hmm. Modern medical instrumentation, research instrumentation outputs just a tremendous amount of data, you know, on the orders of, you know, terabytes in a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of that sort of instrumentation. And that data footprint is just increasing over time. So the management of that sort of data is a real challenge, right? You know, how do you produce it? How do you store it? How do you analyze it? What do you do with the results? How much of it can you keep? How much of it's transitional? It's actually pretty interesting how much of this data really is transitional.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe 29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
My guest for today's episode of the All Things Ops podcast is Jason McDonald. Jason is an associate director of DevOps at Harvard Medical School. Before he joined HMS, he had a number of positions in system administration, system engineering. And we'll talk a little bit about his background in a second. Jason, it's very nice to have you on the All Things Ops podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
All right. Tell us a bit about yourself. How did you end up where you are today?
It's kind of a winding path, as I think most people in the industry have had. Actually started out working in technical theater, realized it was a horrible way to make a living, and shifted over to IT during the height of the Y2K rush. Sort of cut my teeth on that particular brand of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of been doing it ever since. So, you know, 25 plus years now.
All right. Yeah. I remember the Y2K where, you know, everybody was worried as, okay, will the world more or less end because of the date switching? In the end, there wasn't much fallout at all. At least I don't remember anything vividly. So the question is, were the doomsday prophets wrong, or was the preparation good enough and things were averted? What do you think?
I think it was a combination. I think there's a lot of, you know, panic and hand waving and hair on fire, but you know, at the end of the day, it certainly would have caused a lot of problems. You know, I don't think planes would have fallen out of the sky and stuff like that. I mean, physics doesn't just stop working because of a date switch. But there's a lot of hard work done by engineering teams around the world, mm-hmm. you know, and really solid work. You know, so I think it was a combination of probably a little bit more panic than was necessary, but you know, in hindsight, that panic is probably what drove the expenditures that allowed people to do the good work that they did.
So. Yeah, it's the prevention dilemma. So, you know, if you do it right, the thing that you're trying to prevent doesn't occur. And but yeah, I think it's a combination of both. But I like what you're saying. You know, physics don't, even if some apocalypse movies suggest that physics don't change just because the date changes. Right. So yeah. So back to sort of your professional life. I mean, probably everyone listening here has heard about Harvard and Harvard Medical School. It's a relatively well-known school, I might say. And most people, at least, you know, it's true for me, when they think about universities, they see the professors and the students and the research labs and the lecture halls and so on. But, you know, just as an organization, universities are pretty large, and that requires a lot of IT. Can you give us a rough lay of the land for HMS? How large is the IT organization? How large is your team? You know, do you operate one data center, multiple data centers? What does your IT organization look like?
So IT at Harvard is relatively distributed between the schools. So each school mm-hmm. runs their own IT department, and everybody shares a few common services that we consume from the university as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So Harvard Medical School is pretty isolated for the most part from the rest of the university. We do share a lot of stuff back and forth, but we run a lot of our own internal infrastructure as well.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that has to do because we have additional agreements and working relationships with outside collaborators that the rest of the university doesn't really have. Mm-hmm. Harvard Medical School partners with, some days it seems like, every hospital on earth. We have faculty and researchers from Harvard Medical School that work in pretty much every hospital and research institute in the world. So there's a lot of cross-pollination there mm-hmm. that makes the way that we do things just different enough from the way the rest of the university does things that it's beneficial for us to maintain a lot of our own infrastructure.
Makes sense.
As far as like headcount, last I heard, IT overall at Harvard was somewhere in the 15 to 1700 people range.
Mm-hmm.
Just in IT, we float between 150 and 200 people at the med school. And there's currently 11 people on my team with several open positions.
Yeah. Speaking of open positions, I actually saw that about a third of all open positions in that HMS, that the medical school is publishing, are actually in IT and IT-related fields. So I think that gives you an
idea. Yeah, our IT department is growing pretty aggressively, right? And it's going to continue to for the next year or so. So mm-hmm. any listeners who are interested, please, by all means.
All right. And Boston/Cambridge is a really nice place to work. So,
definitely. We're at the Longwood Medical Campus. So we're in the heart of Boston.
Yeah. I think there's really worse places to be on this earth. So yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
definitely.
Maybe somebody who hears this will check out the open positions. That would be great.
Yeah. Boston's a hell of a city.
Yeah. You mentioned, you work at a medical school, so you know, by definition, you work with patient data. And so I assume that there's a lot of sort of red tape and stringent regulations that you need to comply with also from an IT perspective. How does that affect your daily work?
Regulated data is definitely something that we deal with. We're not a HIPAA-covered entity. We're not a medical provider.
Mm-hmm.
So we aren't actually bound by HIPAA directly. We're bound by a bunch of other different regulations. But, you know, of course, we take, you know, anything that resembles sensitive data very seriously, right? As mm-hmm. I think anybody with any ounce of sense does these days. So we have environments that do comply with HIPAA regulations, even though that's not what we have to abide by, but we use that as a baseline. And then we have a federally secured, a FISMA environment. As well, that we use for specific data sets. But most of the work that our researchers do is using de-identified data.
Mm-hmm.
So what the general populace would call HIPAA level two data, maybe level three at some cases, but not highly regulated data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
We try to keep it that way because it allows for more flexibility for our researchers. you know, it allows them to use more resources with less constraints.
Understood. Now, you know, Harvard Medical School is one of the most prestigious medical research institutions in the world, I think. And the school is doing, you know, some cutting edge stuff. And oftentimes these cutting edge things are underpinned by cutting edge, IT systems. And, when we first talked, we talked a bit about sort of your high performance compute clusters and, what you're doing in the area of HPC computing. What are some of the sort of particular challenges that result from, you know, needing to provide cutting edge resources to these researchers?
So, I mean, that's a good question. It's definitely a challenge. You know, we're labeled the DevOps team. I consider ourselves more of a research ops team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we don't really have a lot of actual direct developers that we work with. We do have some. But there's a lot of challenges that comes with modern, you know, biomedical research. Probably the biggest one, and the easiest to identify is data size.
Mm-hmm.
Modern medical instrumentation, research instrumentation outputs just a tremendous amount of data, you know, on the orders of, you know, terabytes in a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have a lot of that sort of instrumentation. And that data footprint is just increasing over time. So the management of that sort of data is a real challenge, right? You know, how do you produce it? How do you store it? How do you analyze it? What do you do with the results? How much of it can you keep? How much of it's transitional? It's actually pretty interesting how much of this data really is transitional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as the data works through its analysis process, there's, you know, you can have an 800 gigabyte data set that by the time it's done is 80 meg.
Mm-hmm.
And all the rest of that data is just throwaway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is an interesting state of being.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Understood.
But one of the things that we pride ourselves on with our HPC environment is we don't make any restrictions on what our researchers can run in the environment. Mm-hmm. It's not like your standard commercial or corporate HPC environment that's running a very regimented, strict set of workflows mm-hmm. that they can really optimize, you know, and really get as much out of their HPC investment as possible. I mean, a lot of these groups do incredible work where they're super, super efficient in their HPC workflows. Our users can run absolutely anything mm-hmm. from homegrown AI and deep learning workflows to a script researcher literally copy and pasted from a forum on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so trying to manage and optimize those workflows mm-hmm. is a huge challenge.
Mm-hmm. Do you also sort of consult researchers on how to structure their workloads in a way that it makes use of these resources more efficiently?
So the DevOps team doesn't. We actually work very closely with a research computing consulting team,
mm-hmm.
which is a team of actual scientists who are also well-versed in research operations.
Okay.
And they're the ones who actually consult directly with researchers and with our users to optimize it, as well as being our primary feedback loop as to new features and technologies that the research community is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the RCCs that bring that to us that we then go forth and build.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And you mentioned this in our previous talk that actually right now you're looking, I think because of these requirements about containerization for research applications, that you're looking at your HPC cluster in a much more sort of fundamental way right now because of these requirements. Did I catch that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way of putting it. You know, we're constantly assessing the technologies at play, you know, and what the research community is doing, where they're moving from an a workflow standpoint, what technologies are they moving towards, moving away from, you know, how is the research landscape changing, you know, over time, right? As adoption of new technologies comes in, what languages are people using? You know, I mean, historically, it was a lot of Java for a really long time. Now you see predominantly Python. And now we are seeing a rise in containerized workflows. You know, which is attractive to the research community for a number of reasons. You know, the first of which is portability and repeatability. You know, your science is only as good as the ability for someone to validate your results. So containerization is a pretty attractive option there, to be able to send either a container or a spec file with your paper to allow people to not only recreate your experiment, but recreate the environment that you ran it in.
Okay. But that also poses some challenges, I suppose.
It does. Classic HPC, what's considered batch processing, high performance computing, is not particularly container friendly. So that is definitely a challenge. You know, it's complicated, right? Most HPC environments don't run containers as first-class citizens. So basically, you submit a job, it starts a container as though it were any other application. If that container doesn't float its logs or float its error codes, if that container dies, you really don't know why. Right. I think those of us who run a lot of containers are used to, you know, having a lens into the runtime of that container, what it's actually doing. And that's something you don't get in classic HPC environments. So that's a huge problem for our RCCs that we work with to debug things with users. And then they have to float a lot of that up to us, where now I have to commit engineering resources to digging into a direct end user problem. Which is a challenge.
So what's the approach that you're tackling, or maybe you're attacking on both fronts? Is it sort of working on the containers, making sure that they float out their logs, or is it working on the HPC cluster and the scheduling and all that side of the equation?
It is a little bit of both. We do have some labs that build their own containers on campus. So we are working with them to try to strengthen their workflows a little bit and make them a little bit more HPC friendly. But a big part of the challenge that we're looking at is, you know, do we restructure the way that we run HPC? Do we change things like the scheduler to allow us to run containers as first-class citizens and have that transparency into container workflows, but still maintaining the classic HPC functionality that we've been working with for ages.
I'm by no means an expert on HPC computing, far from it. But are there any open source projects going on? Because, I mean, yes, it's a relatively unique problem to have, but you're not the only large research institution in the world. So I imagine there must be some other supercomputing and HPC facilities that, that face similar challenges.
So no, we're absolutely not the only research computing institute in the world. I don't think anybody, at least from the various colleagues that I've talked to, I don't think anybody does containers well yet. You know, there's various plugins. Like, we don't use some things we've accommodated for. Like, we don't use Docker as a runtime. We use a runtime called Singularity, just a little bit more friendly when you're dealing with shared file systems and things like that. It has a slightly different security model. You know, but yeah, running containers as first-class citizens up against standard workflows is not something anybody really has a good handle on yet. We're looking at a bunch of open source tools. We're an entirely open source shop, or almost entirely open source shop. So, I mean, our scheduler now is Slurm, which is an open source project. One of the possible replacements we're looking at is actually HashiCorp's Nomad, which is, really a container orchestration engine, you know, a competitor to Kubernetes, but also does allow you to run classic HPC batch jobs right alongside your containers. So that's technology that we're looking at to see if it can get us kind of the best of both worlds. And they've been a great research partner to work with.
Okay.
So is Slurm, SkidMD, the people who run SkidMD have been absolutely fantastic as a research partner.
I find that to be
true of most open sources applications, to be honest. Once you start working with the company that actually provides whatever that open source solution is, most of them are pretty accommodating and pretty good to work with.
I mean, we try to be as well. You know, we're an open source company as well, and we value that interaction with our users, especially those that sort of push, you know, our product. And I think it's probably the same with tools like Slurm to their limits and say, okay, you know, hey, you know, I just go a little bit further. Can we do that? That's the ones that sort of keep us on our toes. So I sort of seeing it from the other side, from the open source vendor side, I can definitely relate to that. You mentioned that, you know, you also contribute to some of these open source projects by upstreaming some of the things, that you're working on and that you develop. Is that sort of just a byproduct, of your work, or can people on your team, you know, dedicate some of their time to open source projects?
I think predominantly it's a byproduct of our work.
Mm-hmm. Right?
We see something that we need to either fix or feature add, and we'll contribute code upstream to that, either directly through, you know, through an open source project, or by working with the vendor. Like, hey, we noticed this bug. We wrote this to fix it. You know, here you go. It's not all of these open source vendors have a direct pathway for contribution. So sometimes that's a little bit more of a kludgy workflow. But I do absolutely encourage everybody on my team to contribute to open source projects when they have time. If there's something that they're particularly interested in, you know, making that available.
That's great. That's great. I mean, as an open source vendor, that's what I love to hear. All right. Your team does both sort of traditional DevOps, you know, traditional. I mean, how traditional is DevOps? It hasn't been around for that long to be traditional, but also DevSecOps. Where do you see sort of the biggest benefits of integrating these two functions?
Well, I mean, we pride ourselves as being a security-first team. You know, we have a very tight integration with our ITSec team here at the med school. I talk to our CISO every day. You know, and my engineers talk to the ITSec engineers every day. You know, we strive really hard to include security in everything that we build. Right. And really have that security first mindset for all of our projects, whether they're completely, you know, private internal tools to support our team, or, you know, wider publicly available infrastructure tools that the rest of the university uses or are direct user impacting. Because we are technically part of the infrastructure group, a lot of what we do is considered critical infrastructure. So we take that very seriously, you know, and I think it streamlines a lot of what we do, right? If we can provide, when we request a security exception, you know, or security configuration from our ITSec team, if we can provide the actual code that backs up that exception, and we have a tight enough working relationship that we can discuss that code, I think that not only streamlines the process of getting those sorts of configurations approved, but, you know, allows for much greater cross-team understanding of how the environment actually functions. And I think that you know, a huge amount of security nowadays has to include transparency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the various teams that work with the infrastructure that all IT teams provide, whether it's DevOps or not, you know, everybody has to have an understanding of what everybody else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's, of course, subject matter expertise, but at a high level, everybody needs to know what's going on. So people have a better idea as to what impacts their changes have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay. And it's very easy to get lost in siloing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that creates huge security hurdles and, mm-hmm. and potential security vulnerabilities.
Yeah. I had in one of the first interviews on the podcast, I interviewed the CISO of the CISO of IBM Cloud. And he said, you know, most teams benefit from being exposed to more sort of security, you know, be it red teaming or any other sort of security expertise, because, you know, developers and also DevOps engineers, you know, often build things in a way that they solve the problem that they want to solve, and sometimes overlook sort of how could this actually be used for something that is not intended. I think integrating these two functions and sort of always looking at everything also with a security lens, and okay, you know, we build it that it does what it should when used as intended. Now see what happens if it's used not as intended.
Exactly. I fully agree with that mindset. You know, and it can be something as invasive as red teaming, which is fine. I'm fully in support of that sort of practice. But even your low-level basic things, having code scanning built into your deployment pipelines,
mm-hmm.
right, have active monitoring on all of your systems, you know, so you may not notice that, you know, the library that you're including has a bug in it,
mm-hmm.
right, and it may make it all the way up to deployment before your active security scanner notices it, your endpoint mm-hmm. scanner notices it, right? So having those checks at every gate for deployment, you know, right up into runtime, I think is hugely important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense.
And then having a good security team that you can rely on to do, you know, periodic checks where they actually do red team your environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in some cases, even an external third party is beneficial.
Yeah, and definitely. I mean, we also rely on external pen testing services and these kind of things. And I think it's good. It sort of keeps you honest as well.
Yep. Exactly.
Because, you know, that's what they're paid to do. They're trying to find, you know, it's a pretty difficult sort of mindset shift to try to find a mistake you made. Because that would prove that you did something wrong. So it's sort of a cognitive dissonance that this puts you in. And I think this can be to some extent solved by, you know, having an external sort of unbiased party take a crack at it.
Yeah, I think some of that's a cultural issue
mm-hmm.
within IT teams. You know, we have a tendency to baby the code that we write. You know, that's my baby. Right. It mm-hmm. clearly can't be wrong. I try to foster a mindset that none of us can know it all. Right. If the IT industry stopped progressing today and I never stopped studying it, I would still never know everything. Right. And there's no way that you know everything. There's no way that you can catch every bug, every use case, and every exception.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, you have to rely on those external validations and be open to that. You know, it's not about, oh, I made a mistake. It's about, oh, here's an opportunity for me to be better.
Mm-hmm.
right? And definitely. I really try to foster that culture on my team of what can we do to be better today than we were yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Of course, everybody wants to be perfect, but we all know that that's not a reality. You know,
that's
so,
true.
Yeah. You know, one of the tenets of DevOps is continuous improvement, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not just your infrastructure. It's not just your code. It's your team culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Are you all continually improving? Are we getting mm-hmm. better collectively mm-hmm. and individually?
Yeah. Makes sense. Speaking of, you mentioned learning, you know, and continuing to learn. You've been sort of working in the profession of sort of IT and IT administration engineering for more than 20 years. But when did you actually, you know, really start dabbling with computers? What was at, you know, how old were you when you first sort of looked at a screen and saw moving moving bits and bytes?
Actually, I was pretty lucky. My parents had incredible foresight and sent me to a computer-centric school when mm-hmm. I was in first grade.
Oh, cool.
So I was about 5 or 6 years old. I think it was somewhere in the 1981, 1982 timeframe.
Mm-hmm. Now you're dating yourself, but hey, no.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a long time. I'm okay with that. you know, I've earned all these years so far.
Very good.
It's been interesting. You know, it's sort of computers have been something that have been part of my life pretty much my entire life.
Okay. And so so you started working also at school in first grade with computers. How long did it take you to break one?
Oh, when did I break my first computer? Like really break it?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be burned down, but at least that it didn't work anymore. You needed to fix it, or somebody needed to fix it.
Probably, yes. Probably the first time I catastrophically broke an OS was the first time I tried to use Windows 95.
Okay.
Because coming from Windows 3.1, there was a whole bunch of erroneous files there that didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense and were just taking up a ton of disk space.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thrashed them.
Okay. And that wasn't a good idea.
No, that turned out to not be a good plan. But I was maybe 15.
Okay. Okay. All right. Good. So you went for a whole while without causing too much havoc. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, I crashed computers plenty, but
yeah, I mean,
not irrevocably so.
Yeah. Back in the you know, 80s and 90s, these were fragile little beings.
That liked
to crash as well.
Yeah, yeah, you could seg fault your system pretty easily. I mean, just a simple, just a simple array out of bounds was enough to drop a box completely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I mean, how easy is that to just misdo that counter, right? Off by one. That's all it takes.
Indeed. Indeed. So they've gotten a little bit more resilient. I still use Windows as sort of my primary operating system. And I haven't seen a blue screen in a long, long time. So
well, that's good news.
Yeah. So they've gotten better. Oh, I've gotten better. Both possible. Right. We have these rapid fire questions. Actually, I just asked the first two about, when you start working with computers, but you answered, I think the one we like to ask, whether you're more of an open source or closed source person. You know, you said you're predominantly an open source shop. If you had to choose sort of your operating, or if you could freely choose the operating system that you work with, because I mean, oftentimes our organizations decide that for us, you know, which one would you pick? Is it Linux? Is it Mac? Is it Windows?
I'm a Linux guy all the way. Mm-hmm. And I'm very I'm very fortunate that Harvard doesn't play any restrictions. So I'm happy to run my Linux box. I'm on a Linux box at the moment.
Mm-hmm. All right. What's your distribution of choice?
For desktop OSs, Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm. for service?
That's up in the air.
Okay.
It was for a long time. It's been CentOS.
Mm-hmm.
But with their new shift to CentOS Stream,
mm-hmm.
That's not a footing I consider production ready.
Okay.
So we are currently shopping around for a replacement.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the CentOS Stream has obviously ruffled a lot of feathers. Let's call it
really has. I think it was a terrible move on their part.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely affected also a lot of our customers. You know, CheckMK runs on Linux and obviously, so most of our users are also, you know, Linux sysadmins, and you know, many have been sort of considering their options with different outcomes.
There's been a couple of good options that have popped up in the last year or so.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what, as the leaves fall, we'll see.
Once the dust settles, let's see where everybody sort of ends up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing we didn't talk about too much this time, but when we last talked, you mentioned this, that you as Harvard Medical School, you run both a very sizable on-prem environment and on-prem infrastructure, and also sizable cloud infrastructures. And I know that some of the open roles in your team are around your cloud environments. I know that it's not an either or for most organizations, but if you personally had to choose, where you put your chips, is it on-prem or in the cloud?
That's a tough call, right? I'm a pretty old school kind of guy. I like being able to put my hands on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely prefer on-prem, but I'd absolutely see the value in cloud operations.
Mm-hmm. Right?
The rapid turnaround on infrastructure, and availability to really test things. I think it's a fantastic development platform.
Mm-hmm.
But my team has a mandate for portability, and being platform agnostic. We want to provide solutions on the platform that makes the most sense for the research that's being done.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's any one of the major cloud providers or an on-prem solution or some hybrid solution, that's what we want to be flexible enough to build.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where also containerization comes into play, because that enables a lot of that as well.
Yeah, containerization is interesting. It used to be the argument between, bare metal and VMs. And that was sort of a no-brainer argument for us from an HPC perspective, at least, where we wanted to run bare metal,
mm-hmm.
right? Virtualization had a tax associated to it at runtime that we weren't willing to pay. But the overhead for containers now for any meaningful runtime is, so low that it's almost not a consideration anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, a shout out to the engine we use. We use Singularity for our container runtime. And it's incredibly efficient. Mm-hmm. It runs very, very well, which does open a lot of opportunities for continued expansion into containerization, both from a runtime perspective for our researchers and from an infrastructure perspective.
Mm-hmm. So there's still a tax, but it's gotten so low that the benefits seem to outweigh the tax you need to pay.
They seem to so far. Okay. It'll be interesting to see when we're running, 10,000 container jobs at a time,
mm-hmm.
and 10,000 single threaded container jobs at a time, and how much efficiency we actually end up losing at that kind of scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's very much in flux. I mean, it's crazy. Recently, it was Docker's 9th birthday, and I was like, holy cow, it's been 9 years already. But at the same time, it's like, it's only been 9 years since this was actually invented. And you know, if you see how far it has come in terms of adoption, same thing with Kubernetes. I think Kubernetes was open source when 2015 or so, and you know, now it seems like the whole world is on board with Kubernetes. That's an incredible breakneck speed at which these technologies are adopted and change. And so that's it's by no means at an end of where it's going to go, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's absolutely been impressive how much the industry has changed to accommodate containerization in the last, you know, like you said, 9 years. You know, and that's one of the wonders, I think, of the technology community that we have in this day and age is our ability to rapidly adopt new technologies, right? And the whole industry just buys in and like, no, this is a good thing. You know, we should all be looking at this. We should all be taking this seriously. You know, and then everybody comes together to make it better, especially when you're talking about open source solutions, right? Personally, I'm not a huge fan of Kubernetes. I don't think the overhead for Kubernetes justifies the use case that we have. I think if you're a huge container-based services organization, then it absolutely makes sense. Right? But we don't require the 7 nines uptime for any of the services we run. Like I said, we're not a hospital. No one's going to die if our service goes down. Right? Nobody's going to lose millions of dollars. It's an annoyance at best. So I don't want to invest the engineering resources into something as big as Kubernetes.
I mean, Kubernetes has become a complex beast over the last few years with all the different services and features that you can use for these various use cases.
Yeah, and I just don't think we have enough of those use cases to justify it.
Yeah, makes sense. All right. Is there anything besides sort of re-mentioning that you have open positions on your team and Harvard Medical School is looking for talented people that you want to ask of the audience that you're interested in, that you want to point to?
Nothing really huge. Like I said, continue to contribute to open source, you know, regardless of the project, whether it's one that we use or not, it makes the community better. So I really do besiege everybody to contribute, you know, even if it's just, you know, using open source and asking good questions, you know, that often sparks enough conversation to move a project forward. I can say like you said, we are hiring both on my team and in general. Harvard's a pretty great place to work. You know, we're doing some pretty important stuff. You know, we've been doing pretty important stuff for over 200 years now. You know, it's definitely a challenging environment, but it's definitely interesting. Never bored.
All right. I think this is a great sort of famous last words. Great. And thank you for coming on. If people want to reach out to you, what's the best way to find you? Is it LinkedIn?
Yep. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on GitHub. You know, those are probably the most pervasive. I don't do a lot of social media, so those are probably the easiest ways to get in touch with me. And people are more than welcome to reach out.
All right. We'll link to it in the show notes. Then people can find you directly from the podcast page or directly from their podcast player. Jason, thank you so much. Thanks for these insights into sort of research operations and how research computing works and the challenges you deal with daily. It's been super interesting. Thank you so much.
No problem. I'm happy to have the chat. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe29, the CheckMK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.